Good morning, church. So a few months ago, I preached a series or a sub-series on artificial intelligence, and a lot of that research was really interesting to me, just taking a deep dive into a lot of what's being written about that subject these days. And one particular quote has stuck with me, so I want to read it to you again. It's a very short quote from an AI engineer, and he said, very boldly, we are creating God. Now, when I first read that months ago, it was shocking to hear someone say that with so much audacity. Now, this is just one person, and certainly there are really good things that AI has already brought and will continue to bring to the world, especially in the field of medicine, research, and the like. But my guess is you react to this quote the way that I react to this quote. Just what? Why would you say that? I mean, it feels like Tower of Babel in the 21st century. It feels very arrogant to say something like that. Here's the irony. There are a lot of secular people that look at Christians like us and react the same way that we react to that quote. Secular people look at Christians who say, yeah, Jesus is the only way to God. And they think, well, you're crazy. That's bigoted. That's judgmental. How could you not take into account all the other wonderful people in the world, all the diverse worldviews out there? It is so arrogant for you to claim that you are the only ones that can go to the Father. The word that encapsulates this whole idea is the word exclusivity. And last week, I did a whole sermon on it. It was actually based on this one sentence from John 14:6, where Jesus says, I am the way and the truth and the life. Nobody comes to the Father except through me. And so we talked about that. Now, the lens through which I preached, if you were here last week, was more of a philosophical lens. We talked about the big metaphor from the Hindu tradition of blind men touching different parts of an elephant. And we talked about this big idea from more of a philosophical perspective. And if you did not hear that message last week, I'd highly encourage you to go listen to that. But today, I actually want to look at the exact same subject, exclusivity, but from a totally different angle. I want to look at it from the passage itself. And the reason we're spending 2 weeks on this particular topic is because of all the reasons that people struggle with faith. This is one of the top reasons. This is a reason that many people don't become Christians. This is a reason that many people walk away from faith altogether. It's because of this claim of exclusivity. And so I'd like to look at it one more time, this time coming from the passage itself. Because it's really important to ask ourselves this question. When Jesus says, I'm the way and the truth and the life, is he coming at that statement from this comparative religious study as if he's a professor in a college course? I mean, maybe. We'd certainly have to look at the context. The reality is, it is extremely easy to take our own biases and presuppositions and assumptions and opinions and read them back into a passage and assume that it must mean what we think it means because of our own issues and agendas today. So let me give you an example of this. One of the most dominant cultural values of our day is this idea of you be you. And what's behind this idea, at least culturally today, is it's this sense of don't let anybody else define who you are. Don't let your parents tell you who you are. Don't let your teachers, your coaches, your friends, your past. Like, do not be the pawn in somebody else's game. The only one with the authority to tell you who you are is yourself. And so you be you, you do you. I mean, this is everywhere in our culture. Well, it's really interesting when we ask, where did this phrase come from? It's about 400 years old. Comes on the lips of a character in Shakespeare's Hamlet. The character's name is Polonius. Now, here's what's really interesting about Polonius. Polonius' function or role in Hamlet is basically the comic court jester to the main villain. And Polonius is known for making really terrible decisions and giving really awful advice. And so functionally, Polonius is basically like Wormtail from Harry Potter or Jabba the Hutt from Star Wars. And so this entire cultural value, hey, you do you, you be you, don't let anybody define who you are except you, it comes from the village idiot 400 years ago in Shakespeare. So it's just really interesting that we can take our modern presuppositions and biases of you do you and assume, well, that must be what it meant when Shakespeare wrote it. Well, that's not at all what Shakespeare meant when he wrote it. Shakespeare wrote this on the lips of this particular character. In other words, to say, this is a terrible idea. Do not do you. Is that what you would say to Timothy McVeigh in 1995 when he's in the Ryder van driving the bomb to the Murrow building? You do you is an awful idea. But we have to understand context to know that that's what Shakespeare was really talking about. Here's another example. It's just a cryptic, mysterious phrase that you would have no idea what this means without context. It's the simple sentence, it will be there for you. What does that mean? Well, of course, it depends. That could mean a thousand things. If a doctor says this to a patient, then he might mean that the prescription's waiting for you in the pharmacy. If a principal says this to the teacher, he might mean that the smart board that the teacher ordered is ready to be picked up. If a mother says this to a daughter before she takes off for school, it could mean that the mom is saying, hey, when you take your exam today and you're really stressed out, the peace of Christ and the strength of Christ will be there waiting for you. Like, we have no idea what this means unless we have context. So Jesus says, I'm the way, I'm the truth, I'm the life. What's going on in that passage to help us make sense of what he means? I'd like to offer three clues from this particular part of the Bible that, at least for me, help me understand what Jesus might be getting at. Okay, clue number one, it's the physical setting. So this comes from John 14, and this section of the Bible is known as the farewell discourse. So Jesus has announced in John 12 that he's going to his death. He will be lifted up. He will bring glory to God through his death. Chapter 19 is where he goes to trial and then eventually is executed. And so these subsequent chapters between are called the farewell discourse. He talks a lot about the Holy Spirit. He gives a lot of instructions about what the disciples are going to do. But this is like the final words of Jesus in John. So there's a heaviness to this particular scene. In fact, you might think about it like this. Imagine that Jesus is on death row and he's in this holding room before he goes to the electric chair. And you are invited to sit with him for just a few hours before he dies. And so you come into this room and you look through the window and you actually see the electric chair and you're sitting there hanging on Jesus' every word and you're so anxious because you can just feel the sterileness of the room and the white linoleum floor and you feel the lump in your throat and you feel trapped and helpless. You don't know what to do because you know he's about to die, and so you are just hanging on every single word that he's saying. That's the feel of this scene. So if you've watched The Chosen, I think the director Dallas Jenkins does a great job creating the mood of this particular scene. It's heavy. Death is just one room away. So that's one factor to consider when trying to make sense of what Jesus is getting at here. Here's a second factor. It's the promise of hope. So right before Jesus says, I'm the way and the truth and the life, he's actually just made this remarkable statement about hope. So here's what he says at the very beginning of John chapter 14. Do not let your hearts be troubled. My Father's house has many rooms. And the Greek word for that word room, it's this resting place where you would await some more permanent home at some point. But it's a very good place. So don't let your hearts be troubled. My Father's house has many rooms. I am going there to prepare a place for you. And I will come back and take you to be with me. Then he ends this whole statement with this phrase, you know the way. Now there's so much background to this particular paragraph. There's a betrothal allusion. There's a lot of issues about timing that we could talk about. And in fact, in subsequent weeks, later this year, I'd like to unpack this text even further. But for today's purposes, I simply want to point out just a few things from this paragraph. So Jesus is saying to them, don't be troubled. Like, I know you want to freak out. Don't freak out. Why is he saying that? Well, there's two reasons. First, Jesus is making the claim that he is about to go beyond the veil of death so as to reverse death itself. This is an astonishing, hopeful claim. So the plague, which has been ravaging humanity ever since Genesis 3, Jesus is now saying, I'm going to deal with that. Death is about to be sentenced to death. And on the other side of it, Jesus is saying, I'm launching something new. There's a new kind of existence, a new kind of reality, and it's going to be different than any other claim on life after death that has come before me. So this is not going to be some mystical existence in Sheol. It's not going to be some kind of a ghost that you're going to be. And you're not going to live beyond death just because of the memories that people, your loved ones, will have about you. No, Jesus is saying, I am about to inaugurate this new kind of unprecedented reality. I'm inaugurating post-death resurrection. I'm reversing death itself. That's hope. So that's the first thing he's saying. I'm going to prepare a place. I'm living beyond the grave. But then the second part of this is also just extremely powerful. He's saying, I'm not going by myself. Like this post-death resurrection reality is not just about Jesus. It's about Jesus' followers. That's why we have statements like, I am coming back to take you to be with me. Or there are many rooms. As in, there's not a capacity problem for this particular place. And so Jesus here he's making this phenomenal claim. In fact, all throughout the Gospel of John, he's been hinting at this. So for example, chapter 5, he says, whoever believes in me has crossed over from death to life. Chapter 8, he says, whoever obeys my words will never see death. Chapter 11, he says, whoever believes in me will never die. Chapter 12, when I am lifted up from the earth, I will draw all people to myself. So all these statements Jesus is making are now reaching their culmination point. He is now going to launch this assault on death itself, which will be so decisive that, number one, he himself will find life on the other side. And number two, many, many other people will find that life as well. And then the final sentence of that promise, remember, he simply says, you know the way. And at least in my mind's eye, I almost see a slight smile on his face or a twinkle in his eye, almost a slight inside joke like, but you know. Like, you know more than you think that you do about this life beyond the grave. So back to our metaphor of death row. So let's say that you're sitting there with Jesus and you can look through the window and you see the electric chair, and Jesus points through the window and says, that electric chair is real. I'm about to sit in it. It's going to ravage my body. It's going to be awful. You're going to be really sad. But it's not the end. It's not the final chapter. Something's going to happen on the other side of that electric chair. And it's not just about my life. This is also about your life too. Because you, disciples, friends, you're also going to face your own mortality, your own death. And so you need to know that on the other side of that, there's a new kind of reality. And as confusing as that sounds, you actually know just a little bit more than you think that you do about this life beyond death. So you've got the physical setting, It's heavy. Final words before he dies. Then you have this immediate message about hope. Okay, here's a third clue. And this is so important to me to unlocking the power of this statement. What we have is the astonishing preceding action. John 14 is where Jesus says, I am the way and the truth and the life. What happened in John 13, just one chapter before? You can say this out loud. What's the famous scene from that chapter? It's the foot washing scene. So when Jesus says, I'm the way and the truth and the life, the disciples can still smell the soap coming from their feet. Like it's still in the air. So now why would this be important? Or what's going on in the scene? Well, let's step back into John 13 and remember what has just happened. So that chapter 13, starts with Jesus knowing things. In fact, he knows some really important things. The chapter begins with this threefold statement that Jesus knows, number one, where he comes from, number two, where he's going, and number three, why he's here. He comes from the Father, he's going back to the Father, and God has placed all authority under Jesus' feet, which is a way of saying Jesus knows exactly what he's supposed to do. He's going to give his life away. Jesus knows where he came from, where he's going, why he's here. It's funny because those three questions in some ways are the derivative for most of our despair and hopelessness and longing. So when you find yourself having a bad day, or you're in a bad mood, or something's just not sitting quite right within you, maybe you're thinking to yourself, man, I'm bored. Or what am I doing with my life? What am I doing with my days? My life sure isn't measuring up to what I thought it would be at this point. I mean, these are all real questions that we face. But if you keep diving down deeper to where they come from, usually they come from these three key questions about life. What am I doing here? Where did I come from? Where am I going? And so in this scene, the reason the scene is so powerful is because Jesus, he knows. SGA says, I got answers, I just need to know what the questions are. So Jesus here is saying, when it comes to the biggest questions that faced all human beings, I know the answers. Jesus is living in utter congruence with the divine imprint in his being. He knows. He knows exactly who he is. He's the Messiah. He's the Son of Man. He's the Son of David. He's the culmination of the Old Testament. He's the suffering servant. He's the Son of God about to die for the sins of the world. Like, ultimate knowledge. He knows all of it. Everything that you ever wanted to know, Jesus knows. So what does he do? So he got up from the meal, took off his outer clothing, wrapped a towel around his waist. After that, he poured water into a basin and began to wash the disciples' feet, drying them with a towel that was wrapped around him. When you know everything, the one thing that you do is you serve in the lowest way possible. Now, we don't live in a foot-washing culture, and so some of this is lost on us. But one of the powerful truths that emerges from this story is simply this. The most complete life is the life that gives its life away. The most complete life is the life that gives its life away. Or another way of saying this is this. The greatest expression of life is love. Like this is a point Jesus is very clearly stating with the foot washing. I know all of it. Where I come from, where I'm going, I'm from God, going to God. I know exactly why I'm here. So what I'm going to do is I'm going to wash your feet. The greatest expression of life is love. And I don't mean this. I don't think Jesus meant this in an abstract way. This esoteric, wishful thinking, pie in the sky, mind somewhere up there. No. I'm saying concrete. The greatest expression of life is love. in the most concrete sense. It's the kind of love that gets dirty and messy and muddy. It's the kind of love that goes into hospitals. It's the kind of love that gives second chances and third chances and fourth chances and fifth chances. It's the kind of love in a marriage that perseveres when it's really, really hard. It's the kind of love where a parent refuses to give up on their child. It's the kind of love where a friend goes to sit with the addict who just relapsed for the fifth time. It's the kind of love where an advocate will go into the slums to rescue a child. I mean, the greatest power in the world is self-giving love. I mean, this kind of power, it shapes the universe. It heals the wounded. It restores families. It redeems pain. It topples nations. It stops the devil in his tracks. The greatest expression of life is love. And so then at the end of John 13, Jesus hits us with this particular line. Now, I have set you an example so that you should go do as I have done for you. So do you want to know what to do with a lazy Sunday afternoon? You should love. Do you want to know what to do with your 8 a.m. Monday staff meeting? You should love. You want to know what to do with your brother who makes you really mad? You should love him. Or when you're stressed out, love. When you're really frustrated with yourself, love. Just, that's what you do. Jesus set you the example, and now it's your turn to follow. You love. Okay, let's pull some of these threads together. You've got a setting where Jesus is about to die. Then you've got this incredible promise that death is not the end. There's a post-death kind of reality that Jesus is about to inaugurate. And then you have this example. Let me show you how this is done. Let me show you this practical way to live your life. This astonishing act of foot washing. So now putting all that together, now place yourself in this scene where Jesus looks right at you and says, I think with a smile on his face, you know the way. I'm the way. You know the way. I'm the way. Does that strike you as arrogant? Does that strike you as bigoted? Does that strike you as disparaging of other world religions? To me, absolutely not. And the reason this is so important, and the reason I'm spending two full weeks on this one passage is this. If this is a reason that you really struggle coming to faith, or if this is a reason that you're thinking about walking away from faith, I just want to encourage you as much as I can, think again. This is not this horrible statement in the Bible disparaging other people. This is one of the most beautiful sentences ever written in the Bible. This is simply Jesus, your brother in humanity, saying, hey, I know what it's like to be human. I know what it's like to be alive. I know what it's like to face finitude and mortality. I know what it's like to look face to face into death. And all I'm saying is there's a kind of life. There's a quality of life. There's a way of living which transcends death itself. I've discovered this kind of life that actually goes beyond the grave. And all I want to do is show it to you. This is the way. That's all he's saying. One of the most well-known passages in the whole Bible is 1 Corinthians 13. In fact, it's not just one of the most well-known passages in the Bible. It's one of the most well-known passages in all of ancient literature. Love is patient. Love is kind. Does not envy, does not boast, is not proud, is not rude, is not self-seeking. It's an amazing text. Do you remember how that paragraph is introduced in the Bible? It's actually introduced with the final sentence of chapter 12, where Paul says this, and now I will show you the most excellent, what's that next word? Way. And actually in the Greek, it's the identical word to what Jesus says in John 14, I'm the way. Now Paul says this is the most excellent way. Love. Do you know how 1 Corinthians 13 ends? It ends in a cryptic, mysterious tone, but there's one line that's really important. Paul says, when completeness appears, what is in part disappears. And the case that Paul is making in 1 Corinthians 13 is that there are certain things that actually do transcend the gap between life as we know it and life beyond the grave. And most things in the world do not transcend that gap. So we know in part, we prophesy in part, but when perfection comes, when completeness comes, the imperfect disappears. There are three things that remain: faith, hope, and love, and the greatest of these is love. So what's Paul saying? He's saying that one of the only things, maybe the only thing that transcends this life and life beyond death is love. And so the reality is your 401k is not going to make it. And your favorite video game, that's not going to transcend life either. Your favorite pair of sneakers, nope, not going to go with you. But the one thing that will be this continuous thread from this kind of existence to that kind of existence is love. And so you want to be really careful about how you live your life. You want to invest in the things that are lasting. And love is one of those things. It's the way. The way is love. So earlier I told you a sentence that it would really depend on the context for what it meant, and that sentence was simply, it'll be there for you. I read that sentence recently in a court testimony. So it's 2017, and the man on trial was a man named Larry Nassar, infamous doctor of the USA women's gymnastics team. For a number of years, he had, in a horrible way, sexually abused over 250 girls. And so he was on trial. He was actually convicted. He's currently serving multiple life sentences. Well, at this trial, several people gave their testimonies, and one was a woman named Rachel Del Hollander. She was actually the very first woman who bravely came forward to accuse him of what he had done to her. And so in the courtroom, she gave this really moving speech, and here's what she says. She says, the Bible carries a final judgment where all of God's wrath is poured out on men like you. Should you ever reach a point of truly facing what you've done, the guilt will be crushing. And that's what makes the gospel of Christ so sweet, because it extends grace and hope and mercy where none should be found. And then here's the sentence: and it will be there for you. So what in the world could compel a victim of a heinous crime to hold out the hope of the gospel to her abuser? Well, apparently she is driven by something that will last beyond the veil of death. Seems to me that she knows the way. Do you? Our shepherds will be in the back if you need to pray. I'll be down front if you'd like to get baptized. Let's stand and sing.